Welcome back to another edition of Words on a Wire. I am one of your hosts, Tim Hernandez. Today we'll be speaking with poet, performer, artist, musician, and scholar Amalia Ortiz, who is originally from the Rio Grande Valley here in Texas, but she's based in San Antonio right now, I believe. She'll correct me if I'm wrong here. And we'll be talking about her new book, The Canción Cannibal Cabaret and Other Songs. It's an incredible book.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm from the Valley, but right now I'm in San Antonio.
Okay, yeah, that's right. I got it right then.
Do your homework.
Sometimes I get it right. Yeah, that's right. I did do my homework. but it was easy to do with you and your work. I mean, I've been a fan of your spoken word stuff for quite some time. And then when your first book came out, Rant, Chant, Chisme, maybe a couple of years ago, I believe, obviously I was a fan of that. And then this book, I was really looking forward to at some point down the line. I knew it was coming because I'm very aware that you're a performer, and you collaborate a lot with musicians. And so, it seemed inevitable that a book like this would come down the chute. So I'm excited about it.
Hey, yeah, thanks. it was delayed a while because I had a different publisher at first, and people could Google that if they want to find out the Chisme on that. But I landed at Aztlan Libre, which was actually my first choice initially.
Right.
And so I love everything that Juan Tejeda and Anissa have done working with me to put the book together, and I'm super happy with the whole project.
You know, they really are. Juan and Anissa really are visionaries, I think, holding it down there in San Antonio, but in the Southwest and the greater picture as well, and I know that that they just produced some stellar books, and yours obviously the most recent among them. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, working with them as a publisher, which is Aztlan Libre Press. We'll talk a little bit about that further on. But for now, because it's such an intriguing title, The Canción Cannibal Cabaret and Other Songs, why don't you start by sharing us, what, not just the book, but the whole project of The Canción Cannibal Cabaret, what that is and why it exists.
Why it exists. Mm-hmm. I went to graduate school and I was in workshops. And this was pre-Trump, because I feel like post-Trump, right after, there was like this rush right after Trump was inaugurated, there was a rush to get anthologies, political anthologies of the protest poetry out.
Right.
But before that, this was like, a year or 2 years before, there was, at least in the workshops and classrooms, there was this vogue that when I would present some of my poetry, people would say, spoken word has that really 60s identity politics aesthetics, and it's so angry and didactic.
Yeah.
And I was too on the nose, and I wasn't subtle enough. And I was like, some things, at least for my audience who I'm talking to, I don't want to be subtle.
Right.
And I don't mind being called didactic, and why is being didactic such a bad thing?
Right.
And so I just started to build this case for poetry that yells and screams. And so I created this. It's a post-apocalyptic story of this future that's post-literate, where the state really controls who can learn. A little bit Handmaid's Tale-ish, but in that world, this revolutionary figure who starts out as a refugee steals a device and starts is self-taught, and so she can't really pass the device. So the only way of passing on thought is by making writing poems and songs that are easily memorized,
right?
And that share both histories and practical information. I have one song that it's a self-defense for women.
Right.
And so that has to be like something that is very catchy that you can memorize, so that when you're in that moment and if you are being attacked, you remember these self-defense moves.
Right.
And so it becomes like that kind of world, which is actually a world that exists now in places like China. I mean, there's still the griots of Africa, where so many people in the world still get the majority of their histories, their information from an oral tradition.
Right.
And so is this the post technology world that we're living in now, where really kind of Eurocentric thinking that all of the typing and texting is the be all end all.
Right. And, you know, and you have you make a great case for that, as you say, especially in the introduction to the book, which I read twice. And in fact, I may end up wanting to use at some point and for my own performance class. In fact, your book, I want to use. I teach a poetry and performance class here at UTEP, and this would be perfect for that. And but you also talk about, you know, the importance and value of taking poetry. And I use that loosely here because you know your work is not simply poetry, or it's not just poetry, but it's really kind of blurs the lines between poems, song, invocation, and but poems. I'll call them for now. The poems in here, you know, you make the case for taking poems out of the academy and into the streets, as bell hooks would say. You know, and why is that, you know, important? Like sort of site specific, doing site specific work or taking it out of the academy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, spoken word. Performers, they claim three-dimensional space, and it's because they're doing poetry that they're able to have a voice and stand up and start talking in places that, you know, maybe before they're not welcome.
Right.
I'm just thinking of, like, you know, the spoken word tradition of Chicago, these coffee mm-hmm. houses where, you know, these intellectuals would you know, sit and write in quiet corners, and then they have the, you know, poetry readings with the polite golf claps. And then, you know, for whatever reason, POC, working class people, were feeling alienated in those environments. And they're like, okay, I'm going to enter this environment, but, you know, I'm going to be communicating the way that feels comfortable to me, you know,
right.
yelling and jumping and stomping and, you know, feel comfortable claiming space in those environments. And so it's funny with my master's thesis, originally I was told, you know, you just turn in the manuscript. And I was like, I can't just turn in the manuscript. I need to do an initial staging before I graduate, because
right.
I need to show my professors what it is that I created, because it's not a
right.
book. It's not
right.
just these pages with words typed on them.
Right.
And even, like, I still feel like the chair of my thesis, one of my strongest and closest mentors, Emmy Bettis. So I was meeting with her, like, you know, every other week,
right.
Talking with her about the project. And it wasn't till, like, I'm on stage and there's costumes and lights and the band going that I see her face change. And she's like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, what I'm creating is
right.
like it. So, yeah, there's the book. And that's
right.
for people who, you know, so I could get the MFA. Yeah, I got an MFA
yeah.
in poetry. And look, I wrote poetry.
Right.
But it is larger than the book. It's this crazy kind of propaganda campaign that
right.
really is trying to enlist people to action, galvanize people to some sort of revolutionary action, whatever that means to them.
Right. And it very much is a call to action. And even that chant right now that you just referred to a little bit ago about, you know, a chant that had to be catchy to save women's lives, you know, and I don't know if this is the one you're talking about, because we didn't talk about this in advance. But because I read your book, is it the one that says, like, ears, throat, or throat,
yeah,
eyes?
In the event that you are not able
exactly.
to run.
That's right. Throat, temple. All those. And see, like, I mean, I only read your book. I read through it. And I already stood out as something I remember in my mind. So, you know, and I've had the privilege of watching you perform as well, some of these pieces. And they are, I would absolutely agree. As somebody who also has a performance background, I haven't been able to see the entire, except for video clips online, the entire Cannibal Cabaret. But I've seen you perform pieces of it. And absolutely, just it brings it to a whole other level, you know, an engagement for the audience. That said, before I have you, I'd like for you to share a poem. But before you do, the book is also comprised of repurposed songs, or songs maybe that were popular or folks have heard of along the way, and thus the word cannibal. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that before we ask you to share a poem?
Sure. So what happened was I grew up on the valley, on the border in a small town called La Feria.
Mm-hmm.
And you lived there from 3 to 18, and then lived in San Antonio 16 years, Austin for a year, L.A. for 5 years. And then my husband gets this teaching position in the valley. We moved back, and being away for 23 years, 20-something years, the first thing I see is this wall.
Right.
And, you know, it's really hitting me in this visceral way, all these changes, moving back to the border and this political climate. And I hear The Clash. And there was something, I'd heard that song so many times
yeah.
and heard it probably since I was in junior high. This, you know, really, you know, the of the punk canon, and then right. but I hear it differently when they say, "And I live by the river."
Yeah.
And so then I start, you know, researching the Clash and how they really were these disempowered like youth in 80s Thatcher era England, and mm-hmm. Really just expressing their angst in this song, and it hit me in this way that I wanted to cry when it's like, yeah, here I am, so many years later after leaving the Valley, back in that same spot. Feeling powerless again as a grown adult, and I live right. by the river. And so yeah. immediately I rewrote the song. Right. And then I decided to like challenge myself to rewrite songs. And then later the post-apocalyptic story came along, that it's this future where this person is looking back to the old folk songs. Mm-hmm. So then I go down this tunnel of looking at like folk songs and people forgetting the original. Like I rewrite a Lead Belly song yeah. that has been used as, like, some people only know it as a Creedence Clearwater Revival song. Right. And then while I was rewriting that, a friend only knew it as a Ramon Ayala song. And I'm like, no, that's Lead Belly.
Yeah.
And so playing with this future where the origins are unknown, and then that, you know, that's what happens with folk songs. The lyrics change every time, like
that's right.
Sweet Jane by the Velvet Underground.
That's right.
So, yeah, I took a lot of liberties making these songs my own, but each one that I chose in some way had this visceral quality that it was speaking to me, even though it really wasn't written about the border or refugees,
right.
But in some way empowered me to be able to talk about my own condition.
Right, right. And absolutely. And that's one of the aspects I really loved about this. I'm a firm believer in that same concept. What Pete Seeger also called the folk process, or referred to as the folk process, the ever-changing nature mm-hmm. of the lyrics as they evolve through time, and how musicians should be changing the lyrics up to reflect their times, you know, of these popular folk songs. And I really appreciated seeing just the range of music as well, going from, as you referred to, from Lead Belly to, you know, to Dylan, to The Clash, to Ramon Ayala. You know, it was really just an exciting read for me personally throughout. But why don't you share some of that with our listeners right now and read a poem for us?
All right. So I'm going to read, if this is okay, two back-to-back, because there's the poem songs, yeah. which there's music. The song in this one, in this little segment, is going to be Strange Fruit, but I don't sing it. I don't have the Billie Holiday pipes. But before that, in between the songs, there are these prose poems. It kind of they're supposed to sound like these sacred texts that mm-hmm. The followers of La Madre Valiente have memorized. I mean, all of it in their world is memorized. So I'm going to go from one into the other. So, remembering her story. Mm-hmm. In her domestic appointment in a home of the elect, La Madre Valiente would slip out of her quarters late at night to study a restricted device she had stolen away. This was how La Madre began to recover so many herstories lost to the state. Before the pocket eclipse, the learning was web-free. But those untangled herstories were burned or flooded during the fall. It was sometime after the death of her last son that La Madre Valiente began her recitation of the old folk songs. Words on paper, or the discovery of Fuji use of devices, was punished with expulsion from the state gates. And so La Madre began to share her story in secret. She turned to the old folk songs and repeated them among the mothers and the colored. Her campaign spread faster than violence through the tenements. Her anger gained momentum as the dark and poor women's children suffered more than others. Even the Yardi gangs set aside their fracasos with one another to begin to fight for something larger, perhaps two true homes instead of block corners in state yards. The herstories La Madre loved most, those that spread quickest through the tenements, were the songs of workers and mujeres, passed long before the fall, old folk songs of Fujis like us, long forgotten. Rememory of Strange Fruit, with thanks to Abel Mirapol and Toni Morrison. Strange fruit, not hanging, but withering in crowded trucks. Loss is expected in transport. Drivers still get paid big bucks. Brown bodies praying for the pardon of our southern breeze. The South still produces strange fruit, just not entwined in trees. If the fruit survives delivery, it can then be bought and sold. Market prices double if fruit is ripe and not too old, dried and rotting in the desert, trampled, falling off of trains. Bondage continues in this land, though not with chains. Growers and traffickers supply consumer-demanded yields. There's a fortune to be made from strange fruit, fertilizing fields. Rememory of blood on leaves. rememory of blood at root. The profits from this bitter crop outweigh our losses of our strange fruit.
Wonderful.
That was two pieces back to back. One of them tells like the story of the revolutionary leader La Madre Valiente, right. And the second one is supposed to be one of the songs that she repurposes for teaching as a teaching device for her army.
Right. And if you're just tuning in, for you listeners, if you're just tuning into Words on a Wire, that is the voice of Amalia Ortiz, and we're speaking with her today about her new book, The Canción Cannibal Cabaret and Other Songs. Amalia, along with this is, you know, I can't help but see sort of your process here for repurposing some of these songs as a kind of a, you know, a collaboration between yourself and you know, those who originally wrote these songs. But also collaboration seems to be really important in terms of the delivery of this manuscript or this work, because I know that in your performances for this, you also collaborate not only with musicians, but even other poets and students as well. Tell us a little bit about why collaboration, the process for that, is so important.
Well, it's, you know, I think on a personal level, it's community. I wrote a play a few years back, Carmen de la Calle, and I remember in a reading of it, just a general reading, I was doing all the voices, and someone was like, why don't you just do it by yourself? It would be so much cheaper. But there's something, you know, there's something that's on a larger scale that's more grand when you have a group of people working together.
Mm-hmm.
And this, the concept of the book to begin with is about galvanizing and working together. And when I first started writing pieces, it was just me, and then I'd ask my husband to come on. And the first time I really felt like, yeah, something is happening was when I invited one of my best friends to, split up some of the poems so that it's multiple voices. And it, because it is about galvanizing, it's more impactful when you see an army of people working together.
Right.
And then on this other level, I was telling someone at Michigan State yesterday, talking about how we rolled into Austin and we're wearing all of these very revolutionary, some military theme, these uniforms. And as we're getting into the hotel or leaving the hotel to go to our performance, people notice, and it, you know, makes people nervous. And we heard someone mumble, "There's more of them." And I remember thinking, yeah, I mean, that's what I want. I want people to, like, because one person's complaining, one person has a problem, that's so easy to ignore. But you have a whole army of people saying the same thing, then people are going to sit up and take notice.
Power in numbers, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's right. And this and it is not just a physical force, but that physical force meets and matches the force of the words and of the message as well. And also I think you've mentioned your husband, your collaborator, a couple of times, but we haven't said his name. So I'd like to do that now.
Oh.
It's Kip Austin.
My husband
Hinton.
Is Dr. Kip Austin Hinton. And I've made the mistake of during the show introducing him as Dr. Kip before. I don't know if it's too much like Dr. Phil. He's like, you say my full name.
So Dr.
Kip Austin Hinton. And, you know, it's the dynamic of a married couple. Because he's there when I'm composing. There's times when he could hear me deliberating over a word, and he'll give suggestions. And I'm like, please don't. Because I think at least when I was writing the manuscript, I wanted the words to be wholly mine, and I didn't want to, like, give him credit.
I understand.
At that point, it wasn't a collaboration. But definitely once we got into the music, because he's so adept with, like, the guitar. Sometimes I'm singing things, and he hears and he picks up what chords they are.
So there
are three original songs, and I would sing the songs, and he would figure out the chords in the guitar.
Right.
So at this point, he is the musical director of the show.
Right, and he also have included the sheet music for some of these pieces in the back that are arranged by your husband, Dr. Kip Austin Hinton, as well.
So yeah, some of that I think there was it was, you know, a dream of mine. I'm like, at some point, I hear that there's this software that you get where you play the music and it produces the sheet music. And he took the initiative to, he found the software. And I think on his guitar, we have a keyboard, he played the music. And so the sheet music in the back, those are, I think there's three original songs.
Wow.
That he took the initiative to print out the sheet music, which I thought was awesome, because on my own, that would have taken me forever to figure out.
Sure. Yeah, I know. Yeah. It looks complicated. It looks like calculus or something, you know, for me, for somebody who's a totally, you know, who in terms of sheet music, I have no, you know, I have no point of reference. So, yeah, but
yeah,
it's fantastic.
I could play the keyboard like one note at a time so I could figure out basic melodies. So when we get to chords, that's all like beyond my ability. So I'm very grateful to him that he was able to discern from the things that I was singing.
This
larger thing.
Yeah, and it kind of reminded me a little bit. It just kind of subtly reminded me of what Ginsberg would do sometimes, you know, with his musical collaborators as well, create kind of sheet music and these what he called, I think, were parasongs, like parodies of songs, where he'd, you know, use different words for the same melody, or, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, there was some of that is there. But, you know, there are also other – I wanted to talk a little bit about the sort of long history of poetry and performance, and even performance art, that's sort of all intersected. And, you know, there, you know, in the 60s especially, and in the 70s as well, there were groups like The Last Poets, and later on even Inosaki Shange's Choreo Poems, you know. And at one point, you know, I don't know if maybe for me, at least in terms of what I'm aware of, maybe in the 90s was the last wave of groups that were doing performance together like this. I don't know if there are too many around today that kind of are doing this kind of work, you know. But, you know, do you find that that's the case? Why is that? And, you know, and why your own – well, maybe we've already answered that, your own interest into it. But why don't we see as many groups around anymore as we once did? Or do you find that to be the case?
I don't know. I think it's funny because, like, when people contact me, can you come here or, you know, come visit this campus? Honestly, it's, you know, economics. It's cheaper to have one person at a mic. And I think back to when I said I did the reading of the play, the person who was saying, you could do all the voices, why don't you do it by yourself? That would have been so much cheaper, just one person at a mic. And that's something that, you know, that the spoken word that Slam in the 90s did, where they, like, they forced you, it's just one person at a mic, no theatrics, no costumes, no musical accompaniment. Like, can you sell your words just with one person, one body? And, you know, that made people become super innovative.
Right.
And it is, like, you know, just in a more economical way. But like I said, for I think I'm still just kind of chasing my heroes. I look back to, you know, Patti Smith and her band.
Right.
And Henry Rollins, you know, I'm just thinking of, let's be honest, Tammy Gomez was one of the first, definitely, Chicanas that I saw. It was within, I don't know, early 90s, maybe mid-90s, I saw her at the Guadalupe with a band, and that was just, like, to me, just blew my mind, and I loved it as a person who loved punk. At that point in the mid-90s in Austin, she was the punk Chicana.
Yeah.
And to see her, the voice and the poetry holding as much power as the band behind her, I was just blown away by that.
I agree.
And really, that's just who I'm imitating with this project.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a lot of wonderful people like Tammy Gomez and others came out of that sort of 90s wave of music, of poetry and music and spoken word and as well. And I know that you are, you know, you also were one of the highlighted poets on Deaf Poetry Jam that was happening at that time as well. So you have a lot of experience in that area. We're actually, gosh, it's already, we're almost, that's it? Time's almost up, Sam? Sorry, gosh, that's quick. I want to give you a chance to, gosh, hold on a second. Let me take a pause because I have like 10 more questions, Sam. Hang on. All right. Well, let me ask you, Amalia, well, why don't you share with us another poem before we head out here, because I'd like for the listeners to get another chance to hear what your work is about.
All right, so this is like, if it's read just like without the band, it's a chant. With the band underneath it, it sounds more like, I don't know, like 90s Sleater Kinney, that Bikini Kill kind of vibe. But I'm reading it because you brought it up.
Yeah.
And it's one of the few original songs in the show. In the event that you are not able to run, nose, ears, eyes, throat, temple, nose, ears, eyes, throat, temple. temple, nose, ears, eyes, throat, temple, multiple strikes, multiple strikes, multiple, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, multiple strikes, multiple strikes, multiple, nose, ears, eyes, throat, temple, nose, ears, eyes, throat, temple, nose, ears, eyes, throat, temple, multiple strikes, multiple strikes, multiple, don't yell, help, yell, fire. No, don't yell, help, yell, fire, nose, ears, eyes, throat, temple, nose, ears, eyes, throat, temple, nose, ears, eyes, throat, temple, multiple strikes, multiple strikes, multiple, yes, all women are under attack, women and children have got to prepare, not all men, but the numbers are stacked, so you have to take care, you have to stay aware. High, low, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, multiple strikes, multiple, don't yell, help, yell, fire, no, don't yell, rape, yell, fire.
And if you are just tuning in, we have been speaking with the poet, performance artist, and scholar Amalia Ortiz about her brand new collection of performance texts and poems and songs called The Canción Cannibal Cabaret and Other Songs. It's out with Aslan Libre Press. It just came out. You have to go pick it up. This is just a small sampling, but she's got a lot of work online as well. Check that out and invite her to your institution and your school. Amalia, it's been really a pleasure having you on our show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. And, you know, we look forward to everything that you continue to put out. We got to try and get you out to El Paso soon.
Hey, anytime. I have family out there. I'd like to go visit.
All right, Amalia. Well, thank you so much. And we'll talk with you soon. Take care.
All right. You too.